better than my fondest hopes. I almost wish the Russians would stand and fight somewhere, so that we could have a battle and be done with it. As it is, my forces are stringing out somewhat, but only because the lead elements are racing forward so well. I've thought about slowing them down to maintain unit integrity, but...
But speed works for us, doesn't it? Zhang observed.
Yes, it would seem to, the defense minister agreed. But one prefers to keep units tightly grouped in case there is some contact. However, if the enemy is running, one doesn't want to give him pause to regroup. So I'm giving General Peng and his divisions free rein.
What forces are you facing?
We're not sure. Perhaps a regiment or so could be ahead of us, but we see no evidence of it. And two more regiments are trying to race ahead of us, or attack our flank, but we have flank security out to the west, and they've seen nothing.
Bondarenko hoped that someday he'd meet the team that had developed this American Dark Star drone. Never in history had a commander possessed such knowledge as this, and without it, he would have been forced to commit his slender forces to battle just to ascertain what stood against him. Not now. He probably had a better feel for the location of the advancing Chinese than their own commander did. Better yet, the leading regiment of the 201st Motor Rifle Division was only a few kilometers away, and the leading formation was the division's Steel Fist, its independent tank regiment of 95 T-80U main battle tanks. The 265th was ready for the reinforcement, and its commander, Yuri Sinyavsky, proclaimed that he was tired of running away. A career professional soldier and mechanized infantryman, Sinyavsky was a profane, cigar-chomping man of 46 years, now leaning over a map table in Bondarenko's headquarters.
This is my ground, Gennady Yosifovich, he said, stabbing at the point with his finger.
It was just 5 kilometers north of the Gogol goldfield, a line of ridges 20 kilometers across, facing open ground the Chinese would have to cross.
And put the 201st's tanks just here on my right. When we stop their advance guard, they can blow in from the west and roll them up.
Reconnaissance shows their leading division is strung out somewhat, Bondarenko told him.
It was a mistake made by every army in the world. The sharpest teeth of any field force are its artillery. But even self-propelled artillery, mounted on tracks for cross-country mobility, can't seem to keep up with the mechanized forces it is supposed to support. It was a lesson that had even surprised the Americans in the Persian Gulf, when they'd found their artillery could keep up with the leading tank echelons only with strenuous effort, and across flat ground. The People's Liberation Army had tracked artillery, but a lot of it was still the towed variety, and was being pulled behind trucks that could not travel cross-country as well as the tracked kind. General Diggs observed the discussion, which his rudimentary Russian could not quite keep up with, and Sinyavsky spoke no English, which really slowed things down.
"You still have a lot of combat power to stop Yuri Andreevich," Diggs pointed out,
waiting for the translation to get across.
"If we cannot stop them completely, at least we can give them a bloody nose," was the belated reply.
"Stay mobile," Diggs advised. "If I were this General Peng, I'd maneuver east. The ground is better suited for it. And try to wrap you up from your left."
"We will see how maneuver-minded they are," Bondarenko said for his subordinate. "So far, all they have done is drive straight forward, and I think they are becoming complacent. See how they are stretched out, Marion. Their units are too far separated to provide mutual support. They are in a pursuit phase of warfare, and that makes them disorganized, and they have little air support to warn them of what lies ahead. I think Yuri is right. This is a good place for a stand."
"I agree it's good ground, Gennady. Just don't marry the place, okay?" Diggs warned. Bondarenko translated that for his subordinate, who answered back in machine-gun Russian around his cigar.
"Yuri says it is a place for a fucking, not a wedding. When will you join your command, Marion?"
"My chopper's on the way in now, buddy. My cavalry screen is at the first fuel depot, with 1st Brigade right behind. We should be in contact in a day and a half or so."
They'd already discussed Diggs's plan of attack. First Armored would assemble northwest of Belogorsk, fueling at the last big Russian depot, then leap out in the darkness for the Chinese bridgehead. Intelligence said that the PLA's 65th Type B Group Army was there now, digging in to protect the left shoulder of their break-in. Not a mechanized force, it was still a lot for a single division to chew on. If the Chinese plan of attack had a weakness, it was that they'd bet all their mechanized forces on the drive forward. The forces left behind to secure the breakthrough were at best motorized, carried by wheeled vehicles instead of tracked ones, and at worst leg infantry, who had to walk where they went. That made them slow and vulnerable to men who sat down behind steel as they went to battle in their tracked vehicles. But there were a hell of a lot of them, Diggs reminded himself. Before he could leave, General Sinyavsky reached into his hip pocket and pulled out a flask. "A drink for luck," he said in his only words of broken English. "Hell, why not?" Diggs tossed it off. It was good stuff, actually. "When this is all over, we will drink again," he promised. "Da," the general replied. "Good luck, Diggs."
"Marion," Bondarenko said, "be careful, comrade."
"You too, Gennady. You got enough medals, buddy. No sense getting your ass shot off trying to win another."
"Generals are supposed to die in bed," Bondarenko agreed on the way to the door.
Diggs trotted out to the UH-60. Colonel Boyle was flying this one. Diggs donned the crash helmet, wishing they'd come up with another name for the damn thing, and settled in the jump seat behind the pilots. "How we doing, sir?" Boyle asked, letting the lieutenant take the chopper back off. "Well, we have a plan, Dick. Question is, will it work?"
"Do I get let in on it?"
"Your Apaches are going to be busy."
"There's a surprise," Boyle observed.
"How are your people?"
"Ready," was the one-word reply.
"What are we calling this?"
"Chopsticks."
Diggs then heard a laugh over the intercom wire.
"I love it."
"Okay, Mickey," Robbie Jackson said, "I understand Gus's position, but we have a big picture here to think about." They were in the Situation Room looking at the chairman on TV from the Pentagon Room, known as the Tank. It was hard to hear what he was muttering that way, but the way he looked down was a sufficient indication of his feelings about Robbie's remark. "General," Ryan said, "the idea here is to rattle the cage of their political leadership. Best way to do that is to go after them in more places than one. Overload them."
"Sir, I agree with that idea, but General Wallace has his point, too. Taking down their radar fence will degrade their ability to use their fighters against us, and they still have a formidable fighter force, even though we've handled them pretty rough so far."
"Mickey, if you handle a girl this way down in Mississippi, it's called rape," the vice president observed. "Their fighter pilots look at their aircraft now and they see caskets, for Christ's sake. Their confidence has got to be gone, and that's all a fighter jock has to hold on to. Trust me on this one, will you?"
But Gus
is too worried about his force. Okay, fine, let him send some Charlie Golfs against their picket fence. But mainly we want those birds armed with smart pigs to go after their ground forces. The fighter force can look after itself." For the first time, General Mickey Moore regretted Ryan's choice of vice president. Robbie was thinking like a politician rather than an operational commander, and that came as something of a surprise. He was seemingly less worried about the safety of his forces than of what the overall objective was, Moore corrected himself. And that was not a completely bad way to think, was it? Jackson had been a pretty good J-3 not so long before, hadn't he? American commanders no longer thought of their men as expendable assets. That was not a bad thing at all. But sometimes you had to put forces in harm's way, and when you did that, some of them did not come home. And that was what they were paid for, whether you liked it or not. Robbie Jackson had been a Navy fighter pilot, and he hadn't forgotten the warrior ethos, despite his new job and pay grade.
"Sir?" Moore said, "what orders do I give, General Wallace?"
"Cecil B. Goddamn DeMille," Mancuso observed crossly.
"Ever wanted to part the Red Sea?" General Lahr asked.
"I ain't God, Mike," Cinq Pack said next.
"Well, it is elegant, and we do have most of the pieces in place," his J-2 pointed out.
"This is a political operation. What the hell are we, a goddamned focus group?"
"Sir, you going to continue to rant, or are we going to get to work on this?"
Mancuso wished for a Lupara to blast a hole in the wall, or Mike Lahr's chest. But he was a uniformed officer, and he did now have orders from his commander-in-chief.
"All right. I just don't like to have other people design my operations."
"And you know the guy."
"Mike, once upon a time, back when I had 3 stripes and driving a submarine was all I had to worry about, Ryan and I helped steal a whole Russian submarine."
"Yeah, and if you repeat that to anyone, I'll have one of my Marines shoot your ass."
"Sink some of their ships, yeah, splash a few of their airplanes, sure, but trailing our coat in sight of land? Jesus!"
"It'll shake them up some."
"If they don't sink some of my ships in the attempt."
"Hey, Tony," the voice on the phone said. It took Brentano a second to recognize it.
"Where are you now, Al?" the Secretary of Defense asked.
"Norfolk. Didn't you know? I'm on USS Gettysburg upgrading their SAMs."
"It was your idea, wasn't it?"
"Well, yeah, I suppose it was," Tony Brentano agreed, thinking back.
"You must have seen this Chinese thing coming a long way off, man."
"As a matter of fact, we..." The SecDef paused for a second.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, if the Chi-Coms loft an ICBM at us, this Aegis system does give us something to fall back on. If the computer simulations are right."
"They ought to be. I wrote most of the software," Gregory went on.
Secretary Brentano didn't want to admit that he hadn't really thought about that eventuality. Thinking things through was one of the things he was paid for, after all.
"How ready are you?"
"The electronic stuff is okay, but we don't have any SAMs aboard. They're stashed at some depot or something, up on the York River, I think they said. When they load them aboard, I can upgrade the software on the seeker heads. The only missiles aboard, the ones I've been playing with, they're blue ones. Exercise missiles, not shooters, I just found out. You know, the Navy's a little weird. The ship's in a floating dry dock. They're going to lower us back in the water in a few hours."
He couldn't see his former boss's face at the moment. If he could, he would have recognized the "oh shit" expression on his Italian face.
"So you're confident in your systems?"
"A full-up test would be nice, but if we can loft 3 or 4 SAMs at the inbound, yeah, I think it ought to work."
"Okay, thanks, Al."
"So how's this war going? All I see on TV is how the Air Force is kicking some ass."
"They are. The TV's got that right, but the rest can't talk about it over the phone. Al, let me get back to you, okay?"
"Yes, sir."
In his office, Brentano switched buttons. "Ask Admiral Seaton to come in to see me." That didn't take very long.
"You rang Mr. Secretary?" the CNO said when he came in.
"Admiral, there's a former employee of mine from TRW in Norfolk right now. I set him up to look at upgrading the Aegis missile system to engage ballistic targets."
"I heard a little about that. How's his project going?" Dave Seaton asked.
"He says he's ready for a full-up test. But, Admiral, what if the Chinese launch one of their CSS-4s at us?"
"It wouldn't be good," Seaton replied.
"Then how about we take our Aegis ships and put them close to the likely targets?"
"Well, sir, the system's not certified for ballistic targets yet, and we haven't really run a test, and..."
"Is it better than nothing?" the SecDef asked, cutting him off.
"A little, I suppose."
"Then let's make that happen, and make it happen right now."
Seaton straightened up.
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Gettysburg first. Have her load up what missiles she needs, and bring her right here," Brentano ordered.
"I'll call Sacklant right now."
It was the strangest damn thing, Gregory thought. This ship, not an especially big ship, smaller than the one he and Candy had taken a cruise on the previous winter, but still an ocean-going ship, was in an elevator. That's what a floating dry dock was. They were flooding it now to make it go down, back into the water to see if the new propeller worked. Sailors who worked on the dry dock were watching from their perches on whatever the hell you call the walls of the damn thing.
Weird, ain't it, sir?
Gregory smelled the smoke. It had to be Senior Chief Leak. He turned. It was.
Never seen this sort of thing before.
Nobody does real often, excepting those guys over there who operate this thing. Did you take the chance to walk under the ship?
Walk under 10,000 tons of metal? Gregory responded.
I don't think so.
You was a soldier, wasn't you?
Told you, didn't I? West Point, jump school, ranger school, back when I was young and foolish.
Well, Doc, it's no big deal. Kinda interesting to see how she's put together, especially the sonar dome up forward. If I wasn't a radar guy, I probably would have been a sonar guy, except there's nothing for them to do anymore.
Gregory looked down. Water was creeping across the gray metal floor. Deck, he wondered, of the dry dock.
"Attention on deck," a voice called.
Sailors turned and saluted, including Chief Leak. It was Captain Bob Blandy, Gettysburg's CO. Gregory had met him only once, and then just to say hello.
"Dr. Gregory?"
"Captain?" They shook hands.
"How's your project been going?"
"Well, the simulations look good. I'd like to try it against a live target."
"You got sent to us by the SecDef?"
"Not exactly, but he called me in from California to look at the technical aspects of the problem. I worked for him when he was head of TRW.
"You're an SDI guy, right?"
"Well, that and Sam's, yes, sir. Other things. I'm one of the world's experts on adaptive optics from my SDI days."
"What's that?" Captain Blandy asked.
"The rubber mirror, we called it. You use computer-controlled actuators to warp the mirror to compensate for atmospheric distortions. The idea was to use that to focus the energy beam from a free electron laser. But it didn't work out. The rubber mirror worked just fine, but for some reason we never figured out the damn lasers didn't scale up the way we hoped they would. Didn't come up to the power requirements to smoke a missile body." Gregory looked down in the dry dock again. It certainly took its time, but they probably didn't want to drop anything this valuable. "I wasn't directly involved in that, but I kibitzed some. It turned out to be a monster of a technical problem. We just kept bashing our heads against the wall until we got tired of the squishy sound. I know mechanical engineering, some electrical, but not the high-energy stuff. So what do you think of our Aegis system?" "I love the radar. Just like the Cobra Dane the Air Force has up at Shemya in the Aleutians. A little more advanced, even. You could probably bounce a signal off the moon if you wanted to."
"That's a little out of our range gate," Blandy observed. "Chief Leak here been taking good care of you?"
"When he leaves the Navy, we might have a place for him at TRW. We're part of the ongoing SAM project."
"And Lieutenant Olson, too?" the skipper asked.
"He's a very bright young officer, Captain. I can think of a lot of companies who might want him." If Gregory had a fault, it was being too truthful.
"I ought to say something to discourage you from that, but..."
"Captain," a sailor came up. "Flash traffic from SAC-LANT, sir." He handed over a clipboard. Captain Blandy signed the acknowledgement sheet and took the message. His eyes focused very closely.
"Do you know if the SecDef knows what you're up to?"
"Yes, Captain, he does. I just spoke to Tony a few minutes ago."
"What the hell did you tell him?"
Gregory shrugged. "Not much, just that the project was coming along nicely."
"Uh-huh. Chief Leak, how's your hardware?"
"Everything's 100% online, Captain. We got a job, sir?" the senior chief asked.
"Looks like it. Dr. Gregory, if you will excuse me, I have to see my officers. Chief, we're going to be getting underway soon. If any of your troops are on the beach, call them back. Spread the word."
"Aye, aye, sir."
He saluted as Captain Blandy hustled back forward.
"What's that all about?"
"Beats me, Chief."
"What do I do?
Getting underway?" Gregory asked.
"Got your toothbrush? If not, you can buy one in the ship's store. Excuse me, Doc, I have to do a quick muster."
Leek tossed his cigarette over the side and went the same way that the captain had. And there was precisely nothing for Gregory to do. There was no way for him to leave the ship, except to jump down into the flooding, floating dry dock, and that didn't look like a viable option. So he headed back into the superstructure and found the ship's store open. There he bought a toothbrush.
Bondarenko spent the next 3 hours with Major General Sinyavsky, going over approach routes and fire plans.
"They have firefinder radar, Yuri, and their counter-battery rockets have a long reach."
"Can we expect any help from the Americans?"
"I'm working on that. We have superb reconnaissance information from their movie star drones. I need the location of their artillery. If we can take that away from them, it makes my job much easier."
"Tolkunov!" the theater commander yelled.
It was loud enough that his intelligence coordinator came running.
"Yes, Comrade General."
"Vladimir Konstantinovich will be making our stand here," Bondarenko said, pointing to a red line on the map. "I want minute-to-minute information of the approaching Chinese formations, especially their artillery."
"I can do that. Give me 10 minutes.
And the G-2 disappeared back out to where the Dark Star terminal was. Then his boss thought about it.
"Come on, Yuri. You have to see this."
"General," Major Tucker said by way of greeting. Then he saw a second one. "General," he said again.
"This is General Sinyavsky. He commands 265. Would you please show him the advancing Chinese?"
It wasn't a question or a request, just phrased politely because Tucker was a foreigner.
"Okay, it's right here, sir. We've got it all on videotape. Their leading reconnaissance elements are here, and their leading main force units are right here."
"Fuck," Sinyavsky observed in Russian. "Is this magic?"
"No, this is..."
Bondarenko switched languages.
"Which unit is this, Major?"
"Grace Kelly again, sir. To Catch a Thief with Cary Grant. Hitchcock movie, that one was. The sun'll be down in another hour or so, and we'll be getting it all on the thermal imaging systems. Anyway, here's their leading battalion. All look like they're Type 90 tanks. They're keeping good formation discipline, and they just refueled about an hour ago, so figure they're good for another 200 or so kilometers before they stop again."
"Their artillery?"
"Lagging behind, sir. Except for this tracked unit here."
Tucker played with the mouse some and brought up another picture.
"Gennady Yosifovich, how can we fail with such information?" the division commander asked. "Yuri, remember when we thought about attacking the Americans?"
"Madness. The Chinks can't see this drone?" Sinyavsky asked, somewhat incredulously.
"It's stealthy, as they call it, invisible on radar."
"Ничего."
"Sir, I have a direct line to our headquarters at Gigansk. If you guys are going to make a stand, what do you want from us?" Tucker asked. "I can forward your request to General Wallace."
"I have 30 Su-25 attack bombers and also 50 Su-24 fighter bombers standing by, plus 200 Mi-24 helicopters."
Getting the last in theater had been agonizingly slow, but finally they were here. And they were the ace of diamonds Bondarenko had face down on the card table. He hadn't let so much as one approach the area of operations yet, but they were 200 kilometers away, fueled and armed, their flight crews flying to practice their airmanship and shooting live weapons as rehearsal. For some, the first live weapons they'd ever shot.
"That's going to be a surprise for good old Joe," Tucker observed with a whistle.
"Where'd you hide them, sir?"
"Hell, General, I didn't know they were around."
"There are a few secure places. We want to give our guests a proper greeting when the time is right,"
Gennady Yosifovich told the young American officer.
"So, what do you want us to do, sir?"
"Take down their logistics. Show me this smart pig you've been talking to Colonel Tolkienoff about.
That we can probably do, sir, Tucker said. Let me get on the phone to General Wallace.
So they're turning me loose? Wallace asked. As soon as contact is imminent between Russian and Chinese ground forces.
Mickey Moore then gave him his targets.
It's most of the things you wanted to hit, Gus.
I suppose, the Air Force commander allowed, somewhat grudgingly.
And if the Russians ask for help?
Give it to them, within reason.
Right.
Lieutenant Colonel Giusti, Sabre 6, got off the helicopter at the number 2 fueling point and walked toward General Diggs.
They weren't kidding, Colonel Masterman was saying. This is a fucking lake.
1.25 billion liters translated to more than 300 million gallons, or nearly 1 million tons of fuel, about the carrying capacity of 4 supertankers, all of number 2 diesel, or close enough that the fuel injectors on his tanks and Bradley's wouldn't notice the difference. The manager of the site, a civilian, had said that the fuel had been there for nearly 40 years, since Khrushchev had had a falling out with Chairman Mao, and the possibility of war with the other communist country had turned from an impossibility into a perceived likelihood. Either it was remarkable prescience or paranoid wish fulfillment, but in either case it worked to the benefit of 1st Armored Division. The offloading facilities could have been better, but the Soviets evidently hadn't had much experience with building gas stations. It was more efficient to pump the fuel into the division's fuel bowsers, which then motored off to fill the tanks and tracks 4 or 6 at a time.
"Okay, Mitch, what do we have on the enemy?" General Diggs asked his intelligence officer.
"Sir, we've got a Dark Star tasked directly to us now, and she'll be up for another 9 hours. We're up against a leg infantry division. They're 40 kilometers that way, mainly sitting along this line of hills. There's a regiment of Chi-Com tanks supporting them.
Artillery?
Some light and medium, all of it towed, setting up now, with firefinder radars we need to worry about," Colonel Turner warned.
"I've asked General Wallace to task some F-16s with arms to us. They can tune the seekers on those to the millimeter band the firefinders use."
"Make that happen," Diggs ordered.
"Yes, sir."
"Duke, how long to contact?" the general asked his operations officer.
"If we move on schedule, we'll be in their neighborhood about 0200.
"Okay, let's get the brigade commanders briefed in. We party just after midnight," Diggs told his staff, not even regretting his choice of words. He was a soldier about to go into combat, and with that came a different and not entirely pleasant way of thinking.
Chapter 57 Hyperwar. It had been rather a tedious couple of days for USS Tucson. She'd been camped out on 406 for 16 days, and was holding station 17,000 yards, 8.5 nautical miles, astern of the Chinese boomer, with a nuclear-powered fast attack camped out just to the south of it at the moment. The SSN, at least, supposedly had a name, Hai Long. The intelligence weenies said it was. But to Tucson sonarmen, 406 was Sierra 11, and Hai Long was Sierra 12, and so they were known to the fire control tracking party. Tracking both targets was not demanding. Though both had nuclear power plants, the reactor systems were noisy, especially the feed pumps that ran cooling water through the nuclear pile. That, plus the 60 hertz generators, made for 2 pairs of bright lines on the waterfall sonar display, and tracking both was about as difficult as watching 2 blind men in an empty shopping mall parking lot at high noon on a cloudless day. But it was more interesting than tracking whales in the North Pacific, which some of Pak Fleet's boats had been tasked to do of late, to keep the tree-huggers happy. Things had gotten a little more interesting lately. Tucson ran to periscope antenna depth twice a day, and the crew had learned, much to everyone's surprise, that Chinese and American armed forces were trading shots in Siberia. And that meant, the crew figured, that 406 might have to be made to disappear. And that was a mission. And while it might not exactly be fun, it was what they were paid to do, which made it a worthwhile activity. 406 had submarine-launched ballistic missiles aboard, 12 Julong-1 CSSN-3s, each with a single megaton-range warhead. The name meant Great Wave, so the intelligence book said. It also said they had a range of less than 3,000 kilometers, which was less than half the range needed to strike California, though it could hit Guam, which was American territory. That didn't really matter. What did matter was that 406 and Hai Long were ships of war belonging to a nation with which the United States was now trading shots. The VLS radio, fed off an antenna, trailed off the after corner of Tucson's sail, and it received transmissions from a monstrous, mainly underground transmitter located in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. The tree huggers complained that the energy emanating from this radio confused migrating geese in the fall. But no hunters had yet complained about smaller bags of waterfowl, and so the radio remained in service. Built to send messages to American missile submarines, it still transmitted to the fast attacks that remained in active service. When a transmission was received, a bell went off in the submarine's communications room, located aft of the attack center on the starboard side. The bell dinged. The sailor on watch called his officer, a Lieutenant J.G., who in turn called the captain, who took the submarine back up to antenna depth. Once there, he elevated the communications laser to track in on the Navy's own communications satellite, known as ESSIX, the Submarine Satellite Information Exchange, telling it that he was ready for a transmission. The reply action message came over a directional S-band radio for the higher bandwidth. The signal was cross-loaded into the submarine's crypto machines, decoded, and printed up. To USS Tucson, SSN 770, from SyncPAC. 1. Upon receiving XQT Spec Op signal from VLS, you will engage and destroy PRC SSBN and any PRC ships in contact. 2. Report results of attack via ESSIX. 3. Subsequent to this operation, conduct unrestricted operations against PRC naval units. 4. You will not, repeat, not engage commercial traffic of any kind. SyncPAC sends. End message. Well, it's about goddamn time, the CO observed to his executive officer. Doesn't say when to expect it, the XO observed. Call it 2 hours, the captain said. Let's close to 10,000 yards. Get the troops perked up. Spin up the weapons. Aye. Anything else close? There's a Chinese frigate off to the north, about 30 miles. Okay, after we do the subs, we'll harpoon that one. Then we'll close to finish it off, if necessary. Right. The XO went forward to the attack center. He checked his watch. It was dark topside. It didn't really matter to anyone aboard the submarine, but darkness made everybody feel a little more secure for some reason or other. Even the XO. It was tenser now. Giusti's reconnaissance troopers were now within 20 miles of the expected Chinese positions. That put them inside artillery range, and that made the job serious. The mission was to advance to contact, and to find a hole in the Chinese positions for the division to exploit. The secondary objective was to shoot through the gap and break into the Chinese logistical area, just over the river from where they'd made their breakthrough. There they would rape and pillage, as Lieutenant Colonel Giusti thought of it, probably turning north to roll up the Chinese rear with one or two brigades, and probably leaving the third to remain in place astride the Chinese line of communications as a blocking force. His troopers had all put on their makeup, as some called it, their camouflage paint, darkening the natural light spots of the face and lightening the dark ones. It had the overall effect of making them look like green and black space aliens. The advance would be mounted, for the most part, with the cavalry scouts mostly staying in their Bradleys and depending on the thermal imaging viewers used by the driver and gunner to spot enemies. They'd be jumping out occasionally, though, and so everyone checked his PVS-11 personal night vision system. Every trooper had 3 sets of fresh AA batteries that were as important as the magazines for their M16A2 rifles. Most of the men gobbled down an MRE ration and chased it with water, and often some aspirin or Tylenol to ward off minor aches and pains that might come from bumps or sprains. They all traded looks and jokes to lighten the stress of the night, plus the usual brave words meant as much for themselves as for others. Sergeants and junior officers reminded the men of their training and told them to be confident in their abilities. Then, on radioed command, the Bradleys started off, leading the heavier main battle tanks off to the enemy, moving initially at about 10 miles per hour. The squadron's helicopters were up, all 16 of them, moving very cautiously because armor on a helicopter is about as valuable as a sheet of newspaper, and because someone on the ground only needed a thermal imaging viewer to see them, and a heat-seeking missile would snuff them out of the sky. The enemy had light flak, too, and that was just as deadly. The OH-58D Kiowa Warriors had good night vision systems, and in training the flight crews had learned to be confident of them. But people didn't often die in training. Knowing that there were people out there with live weapons and the orders to make use of them made everyone discount some of the lessons they'd learned. Getting shot down in one of those exercises meant being told over the radio to land, and maybe getting a tongue-lashing from the company commander for screwing up, which usually ended with a reminder that in real combat operations he'd be dead, his wife a widow, and his children orphans. But they weren't really, and so those words were never taken as seriously as they were now. Now it could be real, and all of the flight crews had wives or sweethearts, and most of them had children as well. And so they moved forward, using their own night vision equipment to sweep the ground ahead, their hands a little more tingly than usual on the controls. Division headquarters had its own Dark Star terminal set up, with an Air Force captain running it. Diggs didn't much like being so far in the rear with his men going out in harm's way, but command wasn't the same thing as leadership. He'd been told that years before at Fort Leavenworth's command and general staff school, and he'd experienced it in Saudi Arabia only the previous year. But even so, he felt the need to be out forward, close to his men, so that he could share the danger with them. But the best way for him to mitigate the danger to them was to stay back here and establish effective control over operations, along with Colonel Masterman. "Cook stoves?" Masterman asked. "Yep," the U.S. Air Force captain, his name was Frank Williams, agreed. "And these bright ones are campfires. Cool night. Ground temperature is about 43 degrees, air temperature is 41. Good contrast for the thermal viewing systems. They seem to use the kind of stoves we had in the Boy Scouts. Damn, there's a bunch of them. Like hundreds. Got a hole in their lines? Looks thin right here, between these two hills. They have a company on this hilltop and another company here. I bet they're in different battalions," William said. "Always seems to work that way. The gap between them looks like a little more than a kilometer, but there's a little stream at the bottom." "Bradleys don't mind getting a little wet," Diggs told the junior officer. "Duke?" "Best bet for a blow-through I've seen so far. Aim Angelo for it?" Diggs thought about that. It meant committing his cavalry screen, and that also meant committing at least one of his brigades, but such decisions were what generals were for. "What else is around?" "I'd say the regimental headquarters is right about here, judging by the tents and trucks. You're going to want to hit it with artillery, I expect." "Right about the time Quarter Horse gets there. No sense alerting them too soon," Masterman suggested. General Diggs thought it over one more time and made his first important decision of the night. "Agreed. Duke, tell Giusti to head for that gap." "Yes, sir." Colonel Masterman moved off toward the radios. They were doing this on the fly, which wasn't exactly the way they preferred, but that was often the world of real-time combat operations. "Roger," Diggs called. Colonel Roger Ardan was his divisional artillery commander, gunfighter 6 on the divisional radio net, a tall, thin man, rather like a not-tall-enough basketball player. "Yes, sir." "Here's your first fire mission. We're going to shoot Angelo Giusti through this gap. Company of infantry here and here, and what appears to be a regimental command post here."
enemy artillery.
Some 122s here, and what looks like 203s, 8-inch right here.
No rocket launchers?
None that I've seen yet. That's a little odd, but they're not around that I can see, Captain Williams told the gunner.
What about radars? Colonel Ardan asked.
Maybe one here, but hard to tell. It's under some camo nets.
Williams selected the image with his mouse and expanded it.
We'll take that one on general principles. Put a pin in it, Ardan said.
Yes, sir.
Print up a target list?
You bet, son.
Here you go, Williams said. A command generated two sheets of paper out of the adjacent printer, with latitude-longitude positions down to the second of angle. The captain handed it across.
How the hell did we ever survive without GPS and overheads? Ardan wondered aloud.
Okay, General, this we can do.
When?
Call it 30 minutes.
We'll be ready, gunfighter promised.
I'll tot the regimental command post.
Sounds good to me, Diggs observed.
First Armored had a beefed-up artillery brigade. The 2nd and the 3rd battalions of the 1st Field Artillery Regiment had the new Paladin self-propelled 155mm howitzer, and the 2nd Battalion, 6th Field Artillery, had self-propelled 8-inch plus the division's multiple launch rocket system tracks, which ordinarily were under the direct order of the divisional commander, as his personal shotgun. These units were 6 miles behind the leading cavalry troops, and on order left the roads they were on and pulled off to firing positions north and south of the gravel track. Each of them had a global positioning satellite, or GPS, receiver, and these told them where they were located down to an accuracy of less than 3 meters. A transmission over the Joint Tactical Information Distribution System, or JTIDS, told them the locations of their targets, and onboard computers computed azimuth and range to them. Then they learned the shell selection, either common, high explosive, or VT, for variable time. These were loaded and the guns trained onto the distant targets, and the gunners just waited for the word to pull the strings. Their readiness was radioed back to the divisional HQ.
All set, sir, Colonel Ardan reported.
Okay, we'll wait to see how Angelo's doing.
Your screen is right here, Captain Williams told the senior officers.
For him, it was like being in a skybox at a football game, except that one team didn't know he was there, and didn't know the other team was on the field as well. They're within 3 kicks of the enemy's first line of outposts.
Duke, tell Angelo. Get it out on the Ivis.
Done, Masterman replied.
The only thing they couldn't do was cross-deck the take from the Dark Star drone.
Saber 6 was now in his Bradley instead of the safer Abrams main battle tank. He could see better out of this one, Giusti judged.
Ivis is up, the track commander called.
Colonel Giusti ducked down and twisted around the gun turret structure to see where the sergeant was sitting. Whoever had designed the Bradley hadn't considered that a senior officer might use it, and his squadron didn't have one of the new God tracks yet, with the Ivis display in the back.
First enemy post is right over there, sir, at 11 o'clock, behind this little rise, the sergeant said, tapping the screen.
Well, let's go say hi.
Roger that, Colonel.
Kick it, Charlie, he told the driver.
For the rest of the crew.
Perk it up, people. Heads up. We're in Indian country.
How are things up north? Diggs asked Captain Williams.
Let's see.
The captain deselected Marilyn Monroe and switched over to the take from Grace Kelly.
Here we go. The leading Chinese elements are within 15 clicks of the Russians.
Looks like they're settled in for the night, though.
Looks like we'll be in contact first.
Oh, well. Diggs shrugged.
Back to Miss Monroe.
Yes, sir.
More computer maneuvers.
Here we are. Here's your leading cavalry element, 2 clicks from John Chinaman's first hole in the ground.
Diggs had grown up watching boxing on TV. His father had been a real fan of Muhammad Ali, but even when Ali had lost to Leon Spinks, he'd known the other guy was in the ring with him.
Not now. The camera zoomed in to isolate the hole. There were two men there. One was hunched down, smoking a cigarette, and that must have ruined the night vision of one of them, maybe both, which explained why they hadn't seen anything yet, though they ought to have heard something. The brat wasn't all that quiet. "There, he just woke up a little," William said. On the TV screen, the head turned abruptly. Then the other head came up, and the bright point of the cigarette went flying off to their right front. Giusti's track was coming in from their left, and now both heads were oriented in that general direction.
"How close can you get?" Diggs asked.
"Let's see." In 5 seconds, the two nameless Chinese infantrymen in their hand-dug foxhole took up half the screen. Then Williams did a split screen, like the picture-in-picture feature of some television sets. The big part showed the two doomed soldiers, and the little one was locked on the leading Bradley scout, whose gun turret was now turning a little to the left. About 1,100 meters now. They had a field phone in the hole, Diggs could see now, sitting on the dirt between the two grunts. Their hole was the first in the enemy combat outpost line, and their job would have been to report back when something evil this way came. They heard something, but they weren't sure what it was. Were probably waiting until they saw it. The PLA didn't have night vision goggles, at least not at this level, Diggs thought. That was important information. Okay, back it off. Right, sir. Williams dumped the close-up of the two grunts, returning to the picture that showed both them and the approaching Brad. Diggs was sure that Giusti's gunner could see them now. It was just a question of when he chose to take the first shot, and that was a call for the guy in the field to make, wasn't it? There. The muzzle of the 25-millimeter chain gun flashed 3 times, causing the TV screen to flare, and there was a line of the tracers streaking to the hole. And the two grunts were dead, killed by 3 rounds of high-explosive incendiary tracer ammunition. Diggs turned. "Gunfighter, commence firing." "Fire," Colonel Ardenne said into his microphone. Moments later, the ground shook under their feet, and a few seconds after that came the distant sound of thunder, and more than 90 shells started arcing into the air. Colonel Ardenne had ordered a TOT, or time-on-target barrage, on the regimental command post behind the small pass that the quarter horse was driving for. An American invention from World War II, TOT was designed so that every round fired from the various guns targeted on the single spot on the map would arrive at the same instant, and so deny the people there the chance to dive for cover at the first warning. In the old days, that had meant laboriously computing the flight time of every single shell. But computers did that now in less time than it took to frame the thought. This particular mission had fallen to 2nd/6th and its 8 inchers, universally regarded as the most accurate heavy guns in the United States Army. 2 of the shells were common impact fused high explosive, and the other 10 were VT. That stood for variable time, but really meant that in the nose of each shell was a tiny radar transponder set to explode the shell when it was about 50 feet off the ground. In this way, the fragments lancing away from the exploding shell were not wasted into the ground, but instead made an inverted cone of death about 200 feet across at its base. The common shells would have the effect of making craters, immolating those who might be in individual shelter holes. Captain Williams switched Maryland's focus to the enemy command post. From a high perspective, the thermal cameras even caught the bright dots of the shells racing through the night. Then the camera zoomed back in on the target. By Diggs's estimation, all of the shells landed in less than 2 seconds. The effects were horrific. The 6 tenths there evaporated, and the glowing green stick figures of human beings fell flat and stopped moving. Some pieces separated from one another, an effect Diggs had never seen.
"Whoa," Williams observed. "Stir fry."
What was it about the Air Force, General Diggs wondered? Or maybe it was just the kid's youth. On the screen, some people were still moving, having miraculously survived the first barrage. But instead of moving around,
or of running away because artillery barrages didn't arrive in groups of only one. They remained at their posts, some looking to the needs of the wounded. It was courageous, but it doomed most of them to death. The only one or two people in the regimental command post who were going to live were the ones who'd pick winning lottery tickets later in life. If there were going to be as many as two, that is. The second barrage landed 28 seconds after the first, and then a third 31 seconds after that, according to the time display in the upper right corner of the screen.
"Lord have mercy," Colonel Ardan observed in a whisper. He'd never in his career seen the effect of fire in this way. It had always been a distant, detached thing to the cannon cocker. But now he saw what his guns actually did.
"Target. Cease fire," Diggs said, using tanker talk for, "It's dead. You killed it. Find another one." A year before in the sands of Saudi Arabia, he'd watched combat on a computer screen and felt the coldness of war. But this was infinitely worse. This was like watching a Hollywood special effects movie, but it wasn't computer-generated animation. He'd just watched the command section of an infantry regiment, perhaps 40 people, erased from the face of the earth in less than 90 seconds. And they had, after all, been human beings, something this young Air Force captain didn't seem to grasp. To him it was doubtless some sort of Nintendo game. Diggs decided that it was probably better to think of it that way. The two infantry companies on the hilltops north and south of the little pass were clobbered by a full battery each. The next question was what that would generate. With the regimental CP down, things might get a little confusing for the divisional commander. Somebody would hear the noise, and if someone from regiment had been on the phone, the disconnect, first of all, would make people think, "Huh?" Because that was the normal human reaction, even for soldiers in a combat zone. Bad phone connections were probably the rule rather than the exception, and they'd probably use phones rather than radios because they were more secure and more reliable, except when shellfire killed the phone and or cut the lines. So the enemy division commander was probably just waking up with a tug on his shoulder. Then he'd be a little confused by what he was told.
"Captain, do we know where the enemy's divisional CP is yet?"
"Probably right here, sir."
"Not completely sure, but there's a bunch of trucks."
"Show me on a map."
"Here, sir."
The computer screen again.
Diggs had a sudden thought.
This young Air Force officer might eat his meals off it.
More to the point, the CP was just in range of his Miller's batteries, and it had a lot of radio masts. Yeah, that was where the Chi-Com general was.
"Gunfighter, I want this hit right now."
"Yes, sir."
And the command went out over JTIDs to the 2nd 6th Field Artillery. The Miller's tracks were already set up awaiting orders, and the target assigned was well within the slewing angle for their launchers. The range, 43 kilometers, was just within their capability. Here also the work was done by computer. The crewmen trained the weapons on the correct azimuth, locked their suspension systems to stabilize the vehicles, and closed the shutters on their windows to protect against blast and the ingress of the rocket exhaust smoke, which was lethal when breathed. Then it was just a matter of pushing the red firing button, which happened on command of the battery commander, and all nine vehicles unleashed their 12 rockets each, about a second apart, every one of which contained 644 grenade-sized submunitions, all targeted on an area the size of 3 football fields. The effect of this, Diggs saw 3 minutes after giving the order, was nearly 70,000 individual explosions in the target area. And as bad as it had been for the regimental CP, that had been trick-or-treat compared to this. Whatever division he'd been facing was now as thoroughly decapitated as though by Robespierre himself. After the initial fire, Lieutenant Colonel Giusti found that he had no targets. He sent one troop through the gap while holding the north side of it himself, taking no fire at all. The falling 155s on the hills to his front and rear explained much of that, for surely it was a storm of steel and explosives. Someone somewhere fired off a parachute flare, but nothing developed from it. 20 minutes after the initial barrage, the leading elements of 1st Brigade came into view. He waited until they were within 100 meters before pulling off to the east to rejoin his squadron in the shallow valley. He was now technically inside enemy lines, but as with the first good hit in a football game, the initial tension was now gone, and there was a job to be done. Dick Boyle, like most aviators, was qualified in more than one sort of aircraft, and he could have chosen to fly lead the mission in an Apache, which was one of the really enjoyable experiences for a rotary wing pilot. But instead he remained in his UH-60 Blackhawk, the better to observe the action. His target was the Independent Tank Brigade, which was the organizational fist of the 65th Type B Group Army, and to service that target he had 28 of his 42 AH-64D Apache attack helicopters, supported by 12 Kiowa Warriors and one other Blackhawk. The Chinese tank force was 20 miles northwest of their initial crossing point, agreeably sitting in open ground in circular formation so as to have guns pointing in all directions, none of which were a matter of concern to Dick Boyle and his men. It had probably made sense to logger them that way 40 years ago, but not today. Not in the night with Apaches nearby. With his OH-58Ds playing the scout role, the attack formation swept in from the north down the valley. Whatever colonel was in command of this force had selected a place from which he could move to support any of the divisions in the 65th Army. But that merely concentrated his vehicles in a single spot, about 500 meters across. Boyle's only worry was Sam's and maybe Flak, but he had Dark Star photos to tell him where that all was, and he had a team of 4 Apaches delegated to handle the threat first of all. It was in the form of 2 missile batteries. One was composed of 4 DK-9 launchers, very similar to the American Chaparral, with 4 Sidewinder-class heat-seekers mounted on a tracked chassis. Their range would be about 7 miles, just a touch longer than the effective range of his Hellfire missiles. The other was their HQ-61A, which Boyle thought of as the Chinese version of the Russian SA-6. There were fewer of these, but they had 10 miles of range and supposedly a very capable radar system, and also had a hard floor of about 100 meters, below which they couldn't track a target, which was a good thing to know if true. His tactic would be to detect them and take them out as quickly as possible, depending on his EH-60 electronic intelligence helicopter to sniff them out. The code for one of these was Holiday. The heat-seekers were called Ducks. The Chinese soldiers on the ground would also have simple man-portable heat-seekers that were about as capable as the old American Red-Eye missile, but his Apaches had suppressed exhausts that were expected to defeat the heat-seekers, and those who had voiced the expectations weren't flying tonight. They never did. There were more air missions tonight, and not all of them were over Russian territory. 20 F-117A stealth fighters had deployed to Zhigansk, and they'd mainly sat on the ground since their first arrival, waiting for bombs to be flown over, along with the guidance package attachments that changed them from simple ballistic weapons to smart bombs that went deliberately for a special piece of real estate. The special weapons for the Black Jets were the GBU-27 laser-guided hard-target penetrators. These were designed not merely to hit objects and explode, but to lance inside them before detonating, and they had special targets. There were 22 such targets tonight, all located in or near the cities of Harbin and Bayan, and every one was a railroad bridge abutment. The People's Republic depended more on its rail transportation than most countries, because it lacked the number of motor vehicles to necessitate the construction of highways, and also because the inherent efficiency of railroads appealed to the economic model in the heads of its political leaders. They did not ignore the fact that such a dependence on a single transportation modality could make them vulnerable to attack, and so at every potential choke point, like river crossings, they'd use the ample labor force of their country to build multiple bridges, all of heavily built rebarred concrete abutments. Surely, they'd thought, 6 separate crossing points at a single river couldn't all be damaged beyond timely repair. The Black Jets refueled from the usual KC-135 tanker aircraft and continued south, unseen by the radar fence erected by the PRC government along its northeastern border, and kept going. the heavily automated aircraft continued to their destinations on autopilot. They even made their bombing runs on autopilot, because it was too much to expect a pilot, however skilled, both to fly the aircraft and guide the infrared laser whose invisible grounded dot the bomb seeker had sought out. The attacks were made almost simultaneously, just a minute apart from east to west at the 6 parallel bridges over the Songhua Jiang River at Harbin. Each bridge had major pier abutments on the north and south bank. Both were attacked in each case. The bomb drops were easier than contractor tests, given the clear air and the total lack of defensive interference. In every case, the first set of 6 bombs fell true, striking the targets at Mach 1 speed and penetrating in for a distance of 25 to 30 feet before exploding. The weapons each had 535 pounds of tritonal explosive. Not a particularly large quantity, in tight confinement, it nevertheless generated hellish power, rupturing the hundreds of tons of concrete around it like so much porcelain, albeit without the noise one would expect from such an event. Not content with this destruction, the second team of F-117s struck at the northern abutments and smashed them as well. The only lives directly lost were those of the engineer and fireman of a northbound diesel locomotive pulling a trainload of ammunition for the army group across the Amur River, who were unable to stop their train before running over the edge. The same performance was repeated in Bayan, where 5 more bridges were dropped into the Wuryurhe River. And in this dual stroke, which had lasted a mere 21 minutes, the supply line to the Chinese invasion force was sundered for all time to come. The 8 aircraft left over, they'd been a reserve force in case some of the bombs should fail to destroy their targets, headed for the loop siding near the Amur used by tank cars. This was, oddly enough, not nearly as badly hit as the bridges, since the deep penetrating bombs went too far into the ground to create much of surface craters, though some train cars were upset, and one of them caught fire. All in all, it had been a routine mission for the F-117s. Attempts to engage them with the SAM batteries in the 2 cities failed because the aircraft never appeared on the search radar screens, and a missile launch was not even attempted. The bell went off again, and the ELF message printed up as EQT Spec Op, or Execute Special Operation in proper English. Tucson was now 9,000 yards behind Sierra 11, and 15 from Sierra 12. We're going to do 1 fish each. Firing order 2-1. Do we have a solution light? The captain asked. Valid solutions for both fish, the weapons officer replied. Ready tube 2. Tube 2 is ready in all respects. Tube flooded. Outer door is open, sir. Very well. Match generated bearings and... shoot. The handle was turned on the proper console. Tube 2 fired electrically, sir. Tucson shuddered through her length with the sudden explosion of compressed air that ejected the weapon into the seawater. Unit is running hot, straight, and normal, sir, sonar reported. Very well, ready tube 1, the captain said next. Tube 1 is ready in all aspects. Tube is flooded, outer door is open, Weps announced again. Very well, match generated bearings and shoot. This command came as something of an exclamation. The captain figured he owed it to the crew, which was at battle stations, of course. Tube 1 fired electrically, sir, the petty officer announced after turning the handle again, with exactly the same physical effect on the ship. Unit 2 running hot, straight, and normal, sir, sonar said again. And with that, the captain took the 5 steps to the sonar room. Here we go, Captain, the leading sonarman said, pointing to the glass screen with a yellow grease pencil. The 9,000 yards distance to 406 translated to 4.5 nautical miles. The target was traveling at a depth of less than 100 feet, maybe transmitting to its base on the radio or something, and steaming along at a bare 5 knots, judging by the blade count. That worked out to a running time of just under 5 minutes for the first target, and then another 160 seconds or so to the second one. The second shot would probably get a little more complicated than the first. Even if they failed to hear the Mark 48 ADCAP torpedo coming,
A deaf man could not miss the sound of 800 pounds of Torpex going off underwater 3 miles away. And he'd try to maneuver, or do something more than break out the worry beads and say a few Hail Mows, or whatever prayer these people said. The captain leaned back into the attack center.
"Reload AdCap into Tube 2 and a Harpoon into Tube 1.
"Aye, Captain," the weapons officer acknowledged.
"Where's that frigate?" he asked the lead sonarman.
"Here, sir, Luda-class. An old clunker, steam-powered, bearing 216, tooling along at about 14 knots by blade count."
"Time on Unit 2," the skipper called.
"Minute 20 seconds to impact, sir." The captain looked at the display. If Sierra 11 had sonarmen on duty, they weren't paying much attention to the world around them. That would change shortly.
"Okay, go active in 30 seconds.
"Aye, aye." On the sonar display, the torpedo was dead on the tone line from 406. It seemed a shame to kill a submarine when you didn't even know its name.
"Going active on Unit 2, Webbs called.
"There it is, sir," the sonarman said, pointing to a different part of the screen. The ultrasonic sonar lit up a new line, and 15 seconds later, "Sierra 11 just kicked the gas, sir. Look here, cavitation and blade count is going up, starting a turn to starboard."
"Ain't gonna matter, sir," the sonarman knew from the display.
"You couldn't outmaneuver a 48.
"What about 12?
"He's heard it too, Captain. Increasing speed and..." The sonarman flipped his headphones off.
"Yow, that hurt."
He shook his head hard.
"Unit impact on Sierra 11, sir."
The captain picked up a spare set of headphones and plugged them in. The sea was still rumbling. The target's engine sounds had stopped almost at once. The visual display confirmed that, though the 60 hertz line showed her generators were still. No, they stopped too. He heard and saw the sound of blowing air. Whoever he was trying to blow ballast and head for the roof. But without engine power. No, not much of a chance of that, was there? Then he shifted his eyes to the visual track of Sierra 12. The fast attack had been a little more awake, and was turning radically to port, and really kicking on the power. His plant noise was way up, as was his blade count. And he was blowing ballast tanks, too. Why?
"Time on Unit 1," the captain called.
30 seconds for original plot, probably a little longer now."
Not much longer, the skipper thought.
The AdCap was motoring along on the sunny side of 60 knots, this close to the surface. Webbs went active on it, and the fish was immediately in acquisition. A well-trained crew would have fired off a torpedo of their own, just to scare their attacker off, and maybe escape if the first fish missed. Not much of a play, but it cost you nothing to do it, and maybe got you the satisfaction of having company arrive in hell right after you knocked on the door. But they didn't even get a decoy off. They must have all been asleep. Certainly not very awake. Not very alert. Didn't they know there was a war going on? 25 seconds later, they found out the hard way, when another splotch appeared on the sonar display.
Well, he thought, 2 for 2. That was pretty easy.
He stepped back into the attack center and lifted a microphone.
"Now hear this. This is the captain speaking. We just launched 2 fish on a pair of Tricom submarines. We won't be seeing either one of them anymore. Well done to everybody. That is all."
Then he looked over at his communications officer. "Prepare a dispatch to Sinkland. 406 destroyed at 2256 Zulu, along with escorting SSN. Now engaging frigate. Send that off when we get to antenna depth."
"Yes, sir."
"Tracking party, we have a frigate bearing 216. Let's get a track on him so we can harpoon his ass."
"Aye, sir," said the lieutenant manning the tracking plot.
It was approaching 6 in the evening in Washington, where everybody who was somebody was watching TV, but not the commercial kind. The Dark Star feeds were going up on encrypted satellite links, and being distributed around Washington over dedicated military fiber optic lines.